Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is here on WEAA FM, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, celebrating 88 days of summer. And details are available at weaa.org. And WEAA is supported in part by AAA Mid-Atlantic. More information at AAA.com/discounts. And we're going to, before we jump into our conversation, I almost forgot it's been so long since I've done this live. It's been about a week. That we are do our little day in history, what happened today in history. And actually some really interesting things that we should think about. This is the birthday of George Dixon. George Dixon was born in a place in Nova Scotia called Africville in 1870. He went on to become one of the great boxers in American history. But if he was born in Africville, that meant that he was descended from slaves who fought for their freedom in this country in the 18th century against the Americans with the British, then fled to what is now Halifax, and created a community, an all-black community in Halifax, that was also the home of many people who fled slavery here in America. When he was 17 years old, he left for Boston, and he ended up becoming one of the most important boxers in history. He won two world titles, the first black man to win a world title. He won them as a bantamweight and as a featherweight. But more interestingly about this guy, we don't even know much about George Dixon. We hear about so many others. Is that he's the guy who invented training techniques like the suspended punching bag that if you ever boxed, everybody uses. He invented that bag. We don't hear about that very much. He invented the art of shadow boxing in the fight game and pioneered what's called scientific boxing. He was the man who kind of created modern boxing in its style today. This was also the year in 1895 that the first National Convention of Black Women was held in Boston, Massachusetts. And it's the day that the preliminary delegation from Mother Jones March of the Mill Children in Philly to Teddy Roosevelt's summer home in Oyster Bay. This was to push child labor. They forced child labor laws. They weren't allowed through the gates. This was 1903. But their presence and books being written and a movement being created in that era forced a change in child labor laws in America. It all began there in 1903 here. This is also the day in 1909 that Chester Himes was born, one of my favorite novelists. If you haven't read him, you should. This was also, interestingly, an organization was created in 1919, the National Association of Negro Musicians. Their first convention was held in Chicago, and on that day they awarded a scholarship, their very first scholarship, to a young woman, a singer, whose name was Marian Anderson in 1919. This is also the day in 1932 that the Bonus Marchers went to Washington, D.C. They were hungry veterans of World War I, men who had fought in that war, who had no work, who had no money. They were being told that they were not going to get their payments until 1945, and they stood up to say 20,000 veterans camped out on the lawn between the White House and the Capitol. Two of them were killed because President Herbert Hoover demanded they be evicted, and then Colonel Douglas MacArthur, later General Douglas MacArthur, led the army that assaulted the camp, injured many men, killed two, and pushed out these veterans who were demanding the pay that they were promised. And finally, this is also the day in 1940 that African-American players were able to swing their tennis rackets on the same court as white players in New York City. Of course, here in Baltimore, where we broadcast from just years later, in 1948, that wasn't the case. People were arrested in Druid Hill Park in 1948 trying to play integrated tennis together. Some of those people are still alive. We've interviewed many of them and had their stories in the air here. So la luta continua, the struggle continues. But now, talking about that, we're going to turn our attention to the death of a citizen in Baltimore, Tyrone West. And that happened while we were not on the air here live this last week. And a young man who was killed, a young man, 44 years old, who was killed who died while in custody of the police. We are joined here in studio by Chuma Obeneme, who is a community member who lives in the same community where this happened. He was a witness to what happened. He's a graduate of the University of Maryland College Park, and this fall will start as a medical student at the University of Maryland. And congratulations on your medical school.
Thank you.
No easy trick. Justin Fenton is with us, crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun, who's been covering this. Justin, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Dwight Pettit is with us, defense attorney who's representing clients in lawsuits against the police in many misconduct cases, and he's currently representing the West family. And Dwight, great to see you back in the studio again.
Good to see you, Mark. Thank you.
And Jason Rodriguez is back with us, editing and technical manager for DMVDaily.com and one of the founders of the Baltimore City chapter of Cop Watch. Jason, good to have you back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And later on the program, we will be joined by Jerry Rodriguez, who is deputy commissioner for the City Police Department in charge of the Bureau of Professional Standards with the Baltimore City Police. And we'll be talking to him about this case and more. So welcome. And folks, please join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can jump on and tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages. Make your comments there, which I'll be checking. 410-319-8888. Truman, let me start with you and welcome. I appreciate you coming to the show today.
There's no problem.
You said your family just moved to the neighborhood.
Yeah, we just moved in about 4 or 5 months ago.
So tell me what happened that night.
So basically, I was in an alleyway that was very close to the scene. I was talking to a friend on the phone, and I had heard a cop car, just the siren go off earlier, and I heard some cars, the wheels kind of screech. So I kind of looked to see what's going on, and I heard somebody yell, "Help, help, somebody help me." And the last time he yelled it, I saw the man who actually yelled it. It was, you know, larger man with dreads, and I had seen a baton kind of whip into the air. So at that point, I didn't know exactly what was going on, but I thought, okay, maybe somebody was ganging up on somebody, like random guy in the neighborhood. Let me go check out what's going on. And then I ran up, and I see the same guy who yelled help on the ground, and I just see two or three cops beating on this guy, like kicking him, using their batons to hit him. And then at that moment, I saw it was almost three or four cop cars come at the same time, just from all different directions. I saw one Morgan State Police cop car, and then a couple cars jumped out, and a couple cops jumped out, and they started, some started beating him up as well with like batons kicking, and then others kind of stood around what was going on to almost block what people were seeing, because at that point, a couple people had actually come out in the community and were looking at what was going on. And it kind of went on for a good almost 2 minutes of just the same, to the point where we couldn't actually see the man anymore just because there were so many cops around him actually beating this guy up. And then they all stopped. A couple guys moved away. They had put him in handcuffs at that point, and one cop had his knee on the back of his legs and had his legs wrapped up, and he just wasn't moving. They flipped him over, tried to do CPR with his hands still cuffed behind his back. Then they flipped him back over, uncuffed him, and then they did CPR for the next 10 minutes. The man throughout the whole procedure never moved at all. He was completely unresponsive. And then the ambulance came. They put him in the ambulance. He was kind of foaming at the mouth, it seemed like, or something was coming out of his mouth. And they never turned the sirens on to go to the hospital. They just kind of slowly pulled away from the scene.
And where was he?
They put him in the ambulance, and they just never turned the sirens on. All throughout it, yeah.
And Justin, you've been reporting this from the beginning. I'm curious, your take on from your observation, what happened?
Right. I mean, we have two very contrasting accounts. The police version is that, some of this is official statements, some of this is things I've heard from sources who are knowledgeable about the investigation. They're saying essentially that his car was driving slowly down the street. It was backing up. There was sort of what they would consider suspicious behavior. Pulled him over, put him on the curb, saw a bulge in his sock that they suspected to be drugs, and that at that point he swung at the officer, tried to run, and there was a sort of a definite struggle, to say the least, to try to bring him under control. Now, they've released the dispatch tapes for the officers from the beginning of that traffic stop to the end, where it seems to be a very routine call. They asked for a female officer to come up to the scene to search, because he had a female companion with him in the vehicle. And then you hear them calling very frantically for Signal 13, which means we need more officers. And they call for Signal 13 again. We need help. And we need help. And there's three different calls for Signal 13 over about a 2.5 minute span, at which point they get on the radio and say, we need a medic. And officers I know who've listened to that think that that is favorable to the officer's account, that this was someone who was fighting back, that they were trying to get the situation under control. Now, the other side of that, there is at least 4 or 5 witnesses who say they saw some or all of this and that he was being beaten severely. And one of the most important things, I think, is going to be the autopsy report, which has not been released, has not been completed, apparently. which would give us the cause of death. Right now, the police have not said very much since their initial statement, which is that he struggled and had a medical distress issue, and that could be a host of things. That could be, you know, complications from a beating, or that he had an asthma attack. And so I think there's a lot that we don't know here.
Dwight Pettit.
Well, I think it's a repetitive story that we continue to hear over and over, unfortunately. It was not too long ago was the Anderson situation. I think his name was Anderson, where the young man was slammed to the ground and died subsequently, and nothing happened. And we really think there needs to be an independent investigation by the state's attorney's office of Baltimore City. I know they have some type of team that they have set up in terms of police conduct, but I don't know whether they really have independent investigators who report to the state's attorney, Mr. Bernstein, instead of Baltimore City Police Department. But this is conduct that we are continually hearing over and over. And my office has talked to several of the witnesses on the scene, and are consistent more so with the statement that we just heard from the young man in the studio this morning. And so I disagree as much as I enjoy the writings and so forth of Mr. Fenton. I disagree in terms of if the autopsy, the autopsy report is important, but if it shows that he died of some, say, a heart attack, cardiac arrest or something like, all of this was brought on by the beating, in my opinion. So the conclusion doesn't really matter that much because there was no basis for this to take place. What bothers me as an attorney, if this was a traffic stop, where was the probable cause? And we'll look at that. I hear them saying that the car was doing something operationally suspicious, but there was no probable cause as I see it. If it's a traffic stop, why don't you just get the identification, the license, and you submit a ticket? Why do you have people have to get out of the car, be subjected to mace, be subjected to shock treatment, have to sit on the curb? Why all of this type of negative police activity for a traffic stop? I think that's the main question.
Jason, you weren't there, but you're covering this as well.
Yes, and I had a chance to speak to the family, and I think the biggest thing that really disturbs me is the pain. We're dealing with a family, again, that's dealing with pain. The Anderson family was grieving very heavily, and this family is grieving very heavily as well. So I think that's what really bothers me, is that we're here again. Another situation where we're dealing with an aggressive police force. We thought that a lot of this was supposed to be addressed during this diamond training and some of these new training programs and some of these new community relation type of programs that were supposed to be coming out. But we see still the same aggressiveness from our police department that we continue to see. And it causes problems in the long run with 16, I believe it was like 15, 16 police-involved deaths last year. Here we are again with another police-involved death. A lot of folks are saying that, you know, per capita, our police department is one of the violent police departments in the nation right now. You know, this just doesn't leave a good taste into the community when you have these incidences. Unfortunately, the community sees things differently. They hear things differently. And then, unfortunately, they respond differently to the police once they hear these incidences. They're not as inviting to the police, and they're not as willing to cooperate or to reach out to the police. We see that in this particular case when we went to the visual for Mr. Tyrone West. You know, the family was very animate about their anger at the police and their distrust at the police. This is what we get when we have an over-aggressive police department. And this you know, so-called, quote-unquote, war on drugs that, you know, a lot of times doesn't hold its weight, you know, for the force that they put into it. You know, it's not getting the results that they think they're getting with the over-aggressive nature of our police department.
So I'm just curious. This is an assessment here. And, folks, I really want to hear your assessment out there at 410-319-8888. Your own stories, maybe if you're a police officer, we'd like to hear from you as well. Obviously, and if you are somebody who has experienced issues with the Baltimore City Police or the Baltimore County Police, 410-319-8888, and your thoughts on this particular incident, what it means, what does it go to the heart of for you, 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts. We're here with two reporters, Dwight Pettit, the attorney who is representing the family two reporters being Justin Fenton and Jason Rodriguez, and Chuma Obeneme, who lives in the neighborhood, who saw what happened to Tyrone West. 410-319-8888. So is this, as a young man, Chuma, I'm just curious, growing up in, you grew up in Baltimore?
I was born in the city. We moved to the county. Now we're back living in the city again. Yeah.
So what, tell me what this says to you. I mean, as a young black man who has kind of lived through the city and lived his life, you're 22?
Yeah, 22. Right? Yeah. I mean, initially I was pretty worried about coming out, but then I realized that it definitely could have been me or my little brother, just because they suspected narcotics in the car. It could have been mistaken identity, and then it's me getting pulled out the car or my little brother, and, you know, I accidentally moved my arm one way, and then that's resisting arrest, and then it's me on the ground. So it is. I mean, it's scary. I have friends who are cops, and I think they do, you know, a fine job, but I think there are times when people try to exert their dominance, and then it becomes violent, and that's what it seemed like I saw. I mean, when they say it was a traffic violation, just to keep in mind that it's a residential area. There's a stop sign at a four-way stop. So
very nice neighborhood too.
Yeah. So it wasn't like he ran a red light. It was a stop sign. So
I mean, that's something I think I would ask the policeman to get here. Let me go to the phones right here and let people join us. But 410-319-8888. I cannot remember, except when I was young and got into some confrontations myself, but when a police officer pulled me over and asked for my license, even if I was speeding, which has happened, or my taillight was out going up the highway, I was pulled over. Car's in a mess. You can look in the car and see, I wonder if something's being hidden in that car because there's stuff all over the place. No one's ever asked me for to get out of my car, to sit on the curb, to inspect my car. That's never happened. It probably hasn't happened to you, Justin, either, is my guess.
It hasn't happened, but when driving through the city, you very often see a car pulled over and a person on the curb, so it seems like it goes
all the time.
Yeah, whether it's justified or not, it seems to be the way it goes down.
And it's also what you see is black people being put on the curb.
Yeah, and I think it's another fact that we need to raise here, and that is, as I understand it, and Justin, correct me if I'm incorrect, this is an unmarked car.
Mm-hmm. The police car.
The police car. Mm-hmm. And they were not in uniform. This is very close to what I think they call the jump-out boys, where they have these cars in certain communities. Now, why the car is up there in this very nice neighborhood community, I don't know. But this is not a situation where you're pulled over with a identified, marked car with flashing lights and what have you. These are undercover jump out boy type police cars that in many cases terrorize certain areas of the city in their pursuit of narcotic bust and narcotic information. So I think that adds another dimension, Mark, if I may add.
So I'm going to come back to that. Let me get a couple callers in here. We've lost a couple here who want to get ready, and I promise, and I lied to them. I don't want to be a liar. 410-319-8888. Come right back to your thoughts, Dwight. Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark. How are you today?
I'm well. Welcome.
Good. Mark, I have said, when Bill Phil was commissioner, many times on your show, that until and unless the Baltimore City Police Department becomes an integral thread in the fabric of the community, they could not be successful. And I say that again because I had some personal experience with these so-called traffic stops. I had a taillight burnt out on my car, and I was heading up to Judy's on Park Heights to get me some food about 10:30 in the evening. From Park Circle up to Judy's place at Belvedere, I was pulled over three times for that light being out. So much so that by the time I got up to Judy's, it was 11 o'clock and she was closed. Now, I decided to have some fun with this, so what I did is I bought the bulb, put it in the windshield, but I didn't fix the light. And the one guy gave me a work order. The rest of them just gave me these white and yellow contact tickets. So over a three and a half week period, I got stopped 12 times, and I've got the sheets to prove what I'm saying, for that taillight being out. I just want to know, what is it that they are so desperate for probable cause to pull people over for? What are they really looking for here? And is this being sanctioned by the command staff and by the mayor? I mean, we're in a 60% black city where we have 60% white officers, and I don't see much difference between this police force today and what we had with Pomelo and some of those guys, Taglia, from days gone by. So I'm trying to get an understanding of what is so important about these fights out. That means we got to take an car out of service, an officer, to check people. I don't understand that.
All right. Thank you so much. I mean, I would safe to say, I mean, it is the duty of a police officer, if you're missing a taillight or something's on your car, to pull you over. I mean, because that's a hazard in itself, not having a taillight. But
yeah, but how much is this as stop and frisk like New York? Right. I mean, you know, it might be a little bit over aggressive, you know. And from what I have talked to some of the officers in the past, unfortunately, in a lot of the neighborhoods, especially high crime neighborhoods, they consider everybody to be suspect. You know, so everybody is, you know, has a potential probable cause to them, and they will pull you over in these neighborhoods.
And
you know?
This is not a high crime neighborhood, though.
No, this is a working class, very stable, middle class neighborhood. That's what I'm saying. Why is this unmarked vehicle there, and why is this stop made? Unless they had some additional, or they're claiming that they had additional information about the vehicle, it's impossible that it was a traffic stop. And then, so it's no probable cause to start with. And many times these we've seen that these stops are bogus stops for other purposes rather than traffic.
Right. But when you don't have a civilian review board and internal affairs that is proactive and goes after these fraudulent, you know, stops and says something to these officers about these, you know, over-aggressive stops, unfortunately, these officers know that they can continue to do this. They know that there's a certain line that they can cross. There's never any complaints followed. There's never any, you know, filings of any complaints, you know, in reference to this. You know, folks usually after being sat on the corner in the cold, in the rain, you know, search through their belongings, unfortunately get up and they go on about their lives and never say anything about it. But we know that there's definitely a problem. It's just there's no accountability. There's no protocols in place to hold them accountable, unfortunately.
Justin? I'm just curious as to how you view what's just been said in terms of your reporting and your observation of all this.
Well, I can say that, you know, I did some extensive reporting on the Civilian Review Board just last month, and what he says about it is absolutely true. I mean, by their own by the members' own estimation, it's a joke. They're not given any power. Nobody goes to the meetings, first of all, but if you did, you wouldn't learn anything because everything is done in secret. Their recommendations to the commissioner aren't followed. The board has 9 members, and 5 of them were vacant. And the 4 that were on it all wanted to leave, and it overstayed their terms by more than double because no one was paying attention. I mean, you can't serve 12 years on a board where you can only serve 4 unless no one's paying attention to the board to begin with. And you know, it was very alarming.
That is alarming.
And so, you know, the mayor is plugging new people in. She's made, you know, 5 new appointments. But what are they going to do when they get there?
And Mark, you've heard me say that my office receives 30 and 40 calls a week, and that's been for the last several years. And we can't even begin to handle all the calls we get in terms of excessive force.
And because the Civilian Review Board is a board of no teeth, has very little power.
No teeth, no subpoena.
No, I've been a victim of police brutality and have gone through that.
I have to take a brief break and come right back. I promise my callers, Tyrone, you're the next caller up, and Carolyn and both Calvins who are called in. We're going to get you a call. Stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On the way to the phones here, I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. We also now join the studio, along with our other guests, Councilman Brandon Scott in the studio. Brandon, good to see you again.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
Still here with Jason Rodriguez, editing and technical manager for DMVDaily.com, and with Dwight Pettit, defense attorney who's representing the West family. Also in the studio with us is Chuma Obeneme, who was a witness to what happened, and Justin Fenton, 410-319-8888. course, a police reporter for the Baltimore Sun. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go right to the phones, and we'll come right back to our guest. Tyrone, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Well, welcome.
I'm trying to figure out how is it that we always try to understand these problems and the relationship between blacks and whites in this country without first acknowledging the history and where we've been through our history. And crime and violence, you know what I mean, and hatred seem like it's embedded within, you know what I mean, the history of this country. You know what I mean? And you know, a lot of these officers coming from surrounding counties and bringing that hatred with them when they join the police force, you know what I mean? It seems like they just got the green light, you know what I mean, to take out that, you know what I mean, that hatred, that violence on us as a people, you know what I mean? I mean, we've been, this history speaks for itself, you know? And at some point, I would think that Europeans would start having to do some soul-searching themselves and ask themselves, what is the motive, ulterior motive, behind this hatred towards us as a people? Because we as a people can't keep blaming ourselves. I mean, we want to blame ourselves to take away the blame from the Europeans that's been giving us hell for 400 years. That don't make sense to me.
All right, Tyler, let me get another caller in here. We'll tackle both things that callers bring up to us here at 410-319-8888. Caroline, you're on the air.
So a little bit of what Tyrone just said. I think that we have to acknowledge the history. I'm a black person, but I'm from Africa, and I came here. And just listening to this story just breaks my heart. I mean, when the whole Trayvon Martin thing happened, I told my family, I made a resolution, that's it. You know, let me just go back because I don't even feel safe with my children as a black person in this country anymore. I never felt racism. I never felt dehumanized until I came to America. And it just breaks my heart. I think we have to acknowledge the history that the European man for 250 years in America held blacks as slaves. And when they were forced to end it, they introduced Jim Crow. And when they were forced to end that, we all know what's happening. I mean, where are we safe anymore? We're not safe walking down the street. We're not safe driving in our cars. We're not safe even in our homes, you know? I think we have to, like he said, where is this? What is this hatred that they have for us? If we're so inferior to them, why are they so fearful, especially of our sons and our husbands? That it's just scary. I think we have to address this issue. That we're no longer safe in this country as a people. We can walk down the street. We can do anything. And it just breaks my heart just listening to these stories of black men just getting shot and killed. That's what I wanted to say.
Caroline, thank you so much for participating in the conversation. Brandon, welcome. Good to have you with us. And I think that's the part when I was said to Dwight earlier before we started the program. And you can come and jump in with this, Brandon. I said to Dwight, what actually can change police behavior? What can change this kind of overly aggressive attitude towards black men, especially in this community, that just is over the top? During the break, one of the things Justin Fenton said was, originally they probably pulled people out of cars because they're looking for guns, was one of the things it was one of the ideas, or drugs, or whatever it is that people say they're looking for, but it's this the aggressive nature because of the institutionalized racism inside of our institutions like the police. I mean, it's not just down to being white officers who beat up black men. It's all officers who are doing this to black men in this city because of what the mindset is. So where do you even begin?
Well, for me, I think that the callers hit it right on the head. For me, it's not just as a young black man, it's not just a police thing. It's not just a government thing. It's not just a Baltimore thing or a state of Maryland thing. This is something that's countrywide. And I think that the only way you can begin to have that conversation is to admit, and it's something that we don't like to do in this country, that admit that the big bad R word still exists. You start there, and then you work towards it. And sometimes in actuality, if you talk to the guys in the street, it's the black officers that they don't want to see the most. They think that they are the ones that go over the top more even so than the white officers. So you start to, when we admit that we have those problems and we have those institutions that we need to work on and adjust to our society, but also for me as a young black man, and something that we've been doing, talking about a lot extensively during our 300-man march events, is that we, as young black men, have to realize what we need to do better. In order for us, before, what we've been saying is that we can't point the finger until our house is clean, until we, as young black men, are in line with everything we need to do. And then we'll be in a place where we can say, hey, look, you guys can't do this to us, or you can't do that to us. We have to understand our role in the things, and then we can work as a unit. But I think that when I look at police issues in this town, I think that they incrementally have been getting better over time. I know that, you know, when I was growing up in Baltimore, I couldn't stand on the corner of Park Heights and Cold Spring to go to Rite Aid for 3 minutes without a police officer coming up to me and say, hey, you got to get your you-know-what off of this corner or you can get locked up. Now I can pretty much go up there and do that, and not just because I am who I am. They, all of them, don't know who I am. But I think that incrementally over time it's gotten better. But we still have that, and it's the same. It's the same, I think, it's the same way I liken it to the streets. We still have that small section of those people who like to terrorize the people in our neighborhoods, and it goes both ways. That exists both in police and that exists both in criminals. And I think that we all need to focus our efforts on weeding that bad culture out, so that doesn't continue to spread. Because that, what happens is that one bad officer, he might have a new rookie partner with him, and eventually that guy, if he's going to be with him all day, either he's going to make a choice, either he's going to turn like him, or he's going to not want to work with that officer. And you, most of them don't want
to
do that.
So let me go to the phones here. I'm going to come back to our guests. Yep. Not just the phones. We have with us Deputy Commissioner Jerry Rodriguez, who is in charge of the Bureau of Professional Standards at the Baltimore Police Department, joining us by phone. And Commissioner Rodriguez, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm honored. Thank you.
I guess you heard what Brandon Scott was saying, City Councilman. I don't know if you heard what the caller said just before he began to speak. Did you hear any of the callers before that?
You know, sir, I have just been on for maybe about 30 seconds. I caught the councilman's tail end of his speech.
Okay. So let me just kind of, in a nutshell, wrap it up, kind of to say what they said and have your response to it. One of the things that both callers said, and what Brandon was responding to and the others would have responded to, but you came on the line, we wanted to get you in here, is that we can't begin to address the issues of people dying in police custody or the violence that takes place in community unless we talk about the racism and the racist attitudes that people have towards black people, especially towards black men in this community. And whether you're a police officer who is a man or a woman or black or white or Asian or Latino or gay or straight or whoever you are as a police officer, that's inculcated in the way people are stopped. We were talking about our earlier almost everybody in the panel here who's black has been stopped by the police and pulled out of their cars or knows people who have in their community. White panelists, that's never happened to. You get stopped by a traffic cop and it's give me your license or registration, either give you a ticket or you go on. So there's a problem. And so the question is, how do you get to the root of the problem, and what does the police department do to root that out if, in fact, you all think that is an issue?
Well, first of all, you brought up, and I've heard the councilman speak towards these issues before, and I think also the councilman has a very grounded philosophy and approach, and I think that comes from growing up in the neighborhood. I, unfortunately, am not from Baltimore. I come from the West Coast, but I am a Hispanic male raised in a very diverse community. So I am very sensitive to any issues of racism or biasness. While I have not seen some of that personally, it may be because of my rank, but I will tell you this. The Commissioner Batts has made it very clear that racism or anything less than constitutional policing and the utmost professionalism will not be tolerated in this organization, so much so that he has brought me in to head the Professional Standards and Accountability Bureau to ensure that we mandate that constitutional policing, that philosophy of community policing permeates the organization, not just from the top, but also to its lowest denominator. I can tell you that we are here today at the Academy where both the commissioner and I have addressed new trainees because we want them to understand the philosophy. It's building the foundation for the future culture and police quality service that we expect. The commissioner has made very clear, and it may take time, but we are very proud, and I want to say this very carefully, we are very proud of the hard-working men and women of this organization, but we can always improve, we can always do better, and we will not stop until we are constantly moving forward in that progression of improvement.
But before we go to the phones, I'll let our in-studio guest also come into the conversation with you, Commissioner, that they have their questions and thoughts as well, and we'll go back to the phones. Dwight, looking about to ask
you know,
a question.
I was going to say...
This is Dwight Pettit.
Police officers and policing in this city is absolutely necessary. And you have good police officers as well as a few rogue police officers. But the part of the question that I wanted to address, this, I think the response has to be political response at the top from the administration to the new police commissioner. And I understand Commissioner Bout has said a lot of things will change, but that is yet to be felt in terms of the street level. So the question becomes, how are you all going to institute philosophy into reality? I have a book coming out very shortly, Under Color of Law, and where I talk about the fact that the law empowers and protects people who have certain vested authority, meaning the police. And historically in this nation, we have seen this authority constantly abused when it comes to black males. And in particularly in the last decades, you might see, it seems like it has accelerated. A certain sociological response to what, I don't know. But this is something that America has had to deal with from the time that certain federal laws and protections were passed. And it came under 42 U.S.C. 1983 was the civil rights statutes that prohibited and protected citizens from misconduct by police. And now we see, if we just visit, for example, the Florida situation, we now see that the authority given to police to be abusive is now being generated to be given to private citizens to make discretionary determinations as to when they feel threatened and therefore can respond through deadly force. So something's out of sync here. Something is dramatically wrong in the good old USA, or has been dramatically wrong and is accelerating instead of decreasing.
So the question is, I wonder how any police department gets their hands on this, Commissioner, before we go to the phones, open the phones back up and have our other guests jump back in.
Well, if I may, I think I stated it earlier. The commissioner has made it very clear that we will accept nothing less than the legal application of law. We will not break the law in order to enforce the law. We are not above the law. And wherever there's indication that the law has been broken by any member of this organization, against any member of this community, we are here to ensure constitutional policing for every member, every racial background, every community within this city that either calls home or they work in this area or they visit. And what we will do is ensure that our investigation, that our penalty, if it's warranted, is swift and warranted and appropriate. And is not going to be easy. We understand the challenges that America faces, but we are dealing with it in a very, very dedicated, poignant, and thoughtful way. The commissioner has made it very clear, and I'll leave you with that. Nothing less than constitutional policing will be accepted.
So one last question. I know you have to run, Commissioner, but one last quick question. So does that mean, because we can always, it's defining what is legal and what is constitutional are coming very sticky issues. So is there a conversation about what happens at traffic stops when the people in the car are black or young black men? I mean, my producer's a professional guy, graduated from college. He's been a victim, stopped by the police because he was smoking a cigar, made him get out, sit in the curb, be humiliated, go through his car. It's happened to a number of black – all the young black men in the studio now are young black professional men, one about to go to medical school, one in the city council. It's happened to everybody. So the question is, what are your conversations about stopping that kind of behavior by the police?
Well, sir, we're guided by state and federal law in any enforcement that we do. And while I want, I hope, I desire, and I demand that every contact with our officers – are lawful, are professional, and are above board, I encourage any and every member of society within the Baltimore City that has had anything less of an experience to make contact with my office within the Internal Affairs and report it. That is how we will affect change. We have made it very clear that we will not allow any type of behavior to our community members, regardless of their background, regardless of their origin, anything less that is constitutionally sound within community policing. We, and the commissioner has made that very clear, we work for the community. Our grade, our effectiveness comes from the constituents, those that live, work, and visit this city, of which we are all very proud of. And without the support of the community, this organization, the Baltimore Police Department, cannot thrive. We're well aware of that, and we are working diligently to communicate that again to our lowest denominator, and meaning by our newest recruit.
Commissioner Jerry Rodriguez, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to meeting you in person and having you in the studio here one day soon.
Likewise, sir. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I wish you all a good day.
Take care. Gentlemen, for your response, and then we're going to go right to the phones here. We have a lot of callers calling in. But Justin Fenton, go ahead.
My take on what he said is that generally, I think this administration has come in, this new administration, folks who've done policing in other parts of the country, have expressed a real desire to change things, but I think they've been hit up against two things. Tradition of this police department and some of the state laws are really an impediment to the things they want to do. They've talked about sort of accelerating the internal discipline process. They haven't been able to do that because of the way it is, you know, in the statute. There's also things sort of the way this organization works. And so I think that even if that desire is there, it has been a slow march towards change.
And Mark, just to chime in and to go what Justin is saying, I think that it's a larger conversation that we're having. But I know specifically of things that they have done that would have never been done before, you know, in this town. Actually, as a police department, we've gotten better relating to the police. I won't name names, but 5 years ago, I had someone tell me that the Baltimore Police Department would never take internal affairs complaints online. They do. I had them tell me the same thing about them sending out emails and Twitter alerts that Justin loves so much. They do. I had them say the same thing about taking reports of minor crimes online. They do. And then on Friday night, we actually, at a second 300-man march event, had something happen that was very, very huge, I think, for the city of Baltimore, as where we had the police. They were there, but what happened is we actually allowed those young men to come out, take a couple turns up the street on their dirt bike to get all the young people to come outside. So then we were able to give them the message of nonviolence that we needed to give them. That would never happen in this town, ever, 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 ever. The people have been riding dirt bikes. I grew up with it and went to school with a lot of 12 o'clock boys pretty much since I was 10, 11 years old, and never would you see something like that. But I think that at this critical point in this city, we all realize that the way that we've been doing it hasn't been working. So we have to become new and do new things to try to affect the change that we want as a community, but also in the policing as well.
Let me open the phones and come back to our other guests in the studio at 410-319-8888. Calvin, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Calvin. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I was going to make a quick statement. I was going to say that I feel like the best way for us to defend ourselves from, and I'm talking black men, black women, black people in general, defend ourselves from police brutality is to arm ourselves with the law. And it's sad that I would, I have to reference this, but I think we should go back to what the Black Panther Party did on the West Side and promoted through America with the pocket lawyer, understanding what you can say, what you can't say, how you should conduct yourself when you're confronted by a police officer. And I also would ask that the commissioner actually teach these classes as well. Go out into the communities and tell these young men and women the best way to deal with the cops that might be harassing them, or, you know, it's just doing a regular traffic stop or whatever it might be. And I'm going to add my name into the young black professional's graduate degree who has been stopped, who has been taken out of his car and searched, put on the ground for no reason, driving through the west side of Baltimore. Thank you.
Dwight.
Well, you know, I always say my saying is the proof is in the pudding in terms of what results are getting. I heard what Commissioner Rodriguez said, and I hear the councilman that things have changed. My office has not changed in terms of the phones being lit up by police brutality complaints that we can't possibly entertain. But I look back at – we talk about this case. Let's look back again to the Anderson case. Now, this is a person that was killed in a very, very similar situation. And the state's attorney's office said that he's acting, or the police were acting lawfully within their procedures and practices and exonerated him. We had no internal investigation that I can recall in terms of the police department. So the message that's being sent is that the police department, as well as the state's attorney's office, in my opinion, react in conjunction to protect the officers. And many times they're making defensive statements before the autopsy comes out, before the investigation is completed. They're making defensive statements that the police acted within accord of their rules and regulations instead of seeing any type of independent. And I haven't seen anything from Internal Affairs. You can talk about Internal Affairs, Councilman. You can talk about Internal Affairs, Commissioner Rodriguez. I haven't seen a positive result in my 40 years of practice in Baltimore City from the Baltimore City Internal Affairs Department of the Police Department. Now, if it has happened, you know, somebody showed me.
I felt the same way like Dwight. You know, unfortunately, my experience with Internal Affairs, having personally been a victim of police brutality, unfortunately, the process is broke, and it really needs to be revamped, really needs to be kind of torn down and started over again. The problem is that we have officers policing officers. And in my particular case, I had an officer that was 25 years on the force who was representing and handling my case, my complaint against another officer, who told me at the time of my investigation that he didn't believe my story. So already, you know, I had already, you know, he brought bias, his opinion, to my investigation, my complaint. So unfortunately, the process doesn't work, and it hasn't worked. And you just heard Justin Fenton say, you know, that there's missing members on the Civilian Review Board. You know, there's no accountability in the process, you know, and unfortunately, the streets know that. The officers kind of know that. And Commissioner Gonzalez talks about, Commissioner Rodriguez talks about, officers, you know, being held accountable and going through this process, going through this internal affairs process. But unfortunately, every person that's sitting here right now knows someone that has gone through the process or has heard stories of those who have gone through the process, and the process has fallen short for them.
So let me ask you, before you jump in, as Justin Wright, quickly, when you did that investigative piece on the Civilian Review Board and showed that it was just wasn't there, there's no power there, they weren't doing anything. What about research into where civilian review boards do have teeth?
Oh, yeah. No, that was a major part of the story. I mean, in several cities, and it's, you know, there was a big push to do them in the 90s.
Right.
And some of them are given great power and use that power. And others have power and don't use it, and others don't have power. One of the ones that I found very interesting was the D.C. Setup. And I don't know if anything like that is possible here because they have a lot of funding. But they have, you know, like I think it's like 40 investigators, and they're completely independent. It has a board that is overseen by that is appointed by the mayor, but it's very independent, and they put out these reports that, you know, as a reporter, when I see an annual report come out from a police watchdog agency that's right. 50 pages long, you know, that's gold to me. And we certainly don't have any – we don't have annual reports, period, but we don't have them especially in this area. I think one of the things in terms of whether Internal Affairs is working or not, I can't say whether it's working or not because it is an incredibly secretive process in Maryland. It's easy to compare things to Florida with their sunshine laws. But we have a new reporter who sits next to me, and she spent several years in Florida. And, you know, they can see a police officer's personnel jacket there. They can see that. They can ask for it, and they can see it. We have no clue what's going on with police discipline here. They may be firing people left and right. They may be disciplining people and doing a tremendous job. We have no way of knowing. And that's why it's difficult to gauge this administration or any administration on what they do, because they can say they're doing it. We don't know that they're doing it.
So the question I have very quickly for you, Brandon, we have like three or four minutes left here, mm-hmm. Is why can't Baltimore have stronger laws around civilian review with teeth and funding?
It's actually the state.
I would say to chime in first and foremost, it would be a state law. Then we just have to have that political will in Annapolis to change that. And then you have the police bill of rights and all the other hoops that you have to jump to. And that's what I was going to talk about. When you talk about internal affairs, of course, I know of tons and tons of cases where folks have been disciplined, you know, for incidents, even not just against community members. You know, officers come to me all the time to say, hey, look, my sergeant did this to me or did that to me, especially women and African-American officers. And, of course, I give that information over. I try to make sure that those cases are handled. Same thing for citizens. But I think that as Justin alluded to earlier, what the problem that we're having internally and that we're going to get through, and the commissioner and I don't agree on a lot of things, but this is one thing that we do agree on, is that our systems that are in place and out the police department, especially on the administrative side, are extremely outdated and need to be changed. And in order to do that, one of the things is Jason just alluded to, if you have an officer that's in internal affairs, next month that officer could be on the street in the same district working with the officer that he just investigated. That's a broken thing all around. So we have to change that. And I think that we're going to get there. It's going to take time. But as far as being more open, of course, I love open and transparent government.
So we're just about out of time here. I just want to say that to make some clarity. Are you saying, did you agree to this? I'm curious, Dwight, that we cannot pass a law in the city of Baltimore for a civilian review board that has to be in the state?
Yeah, that's
the, it was implemented by the state.
It's implemented by the state. It's the state of Maryland. It's under state statute. It's one of the code of public laws things. It has to be done by the state.
But the internal investigation apparatus of the police is definitely under the police commissioner and the mayor, since the mayor of Baltimore City appoints and can terminate the police commissioner.
Yeah, that part, Mr. Pettit, you're directly right about. But this is something that we talked about this before on your show, Mark. Sometimes with the police department, they're really a state agency. Right. And in most of the stuff—
I understand that, but the Civilian Review Board was established, I thought, by the city, not by the state.
It happened after Joan Carter Conway was pulled over, actually, and there was a great push to create a civilian review board. There was a lot of debate about how much power it should have, and there was some concessions made. And it has been the way it hasn't changed since it was implemented, even though it didn't turn out to be what it was created for.
So we have to take a break here and wrap up this conversation for today, and I want to appreciate everybody for being here. First of all, Chuma Obeneme, thank you so much for standing up.
Yeah. Thank you.
And seeing what you saw. Good luck in medical school this fall. Good to have you in the studio. Justin Fenton, thank you for being with us from The Sun, who covers crime for the city. Dwight Pettit, one of our noted attorneys, defense attorneys, who's been filing lawsuits, police misconduct for the last 40 years, and now represents the West family. Thank you for being here, Dwight, as well.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Jason Rodriguez, always good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Editing and technical manager for DMVDaily.com and councilman. Brandon Scott, good to have you in the studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you and all the others who did that march on Friday night and walked the streets to let voices be heard about violence in our communities. And I also want to thank Deputy Commissioner Jerry Rodriguez for joining us earlier in this program. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to continue a conversation in some ways, but take it national. We'll look at stand-your-ground laws. Stay with us. We'll be right back.